Alana Kelman, and along with my husband, Jay, we serve as the coordinators of the Torah Ethics Project in Toronto. By now, most of you are familiar with this project, whose aim it is to increase awareness of, and thereby to increase performance of, the interpersonal Bein Adam L'Chaveiro aspects of Jewish law. The S. Daniel Abraham and Ira Rinert Torah Ethics Project of the Orthodox Caucus has met with great success in New York and in a growing number of other communities. We were very pleased with the wonderful response in Toronto last year, and due to the involvement of many people, the influence of the program seems to be even greater this year. The kickoff lecture for this year's theme given by Rabbi Mark Angel was attended by close to 300 people. Through the local schools, shuls, and other community institutions, this year's message of evaluating our actions to increase Kiddush Hashem is being promoted. More than 25 organizations have received detailed source materials relevant to their membership so that they can run their own programs for their own populations. We encourage each of you, hopefully inspired by this evening's program, to go back to the organizations that you're involved with and to help them to do programs to increase the level of Kiddush Hashem. As the coordinators of the program, we are always happy to provide materials and suggestions and to be helpful in any way that we are able. On an individual level, you will have noticed the Purple Home Discussion Guides. These brochures are for family or small group discussions. The guides include scenarios on various age levels, as well as carefully selected source materials designed to stimulate serious thought on the topic. These are to guide you help each of us to engage friends and family members in discussions on the topic. If each of us will go home today and say, how can I make a better impression as a Jew and as a person, and how can I act in a way that brings honor to the Torah way of life, we will be well on our way to our goal. We appreciate the leadership and guidance of Rabbi Basil Herring of New York, who shared the project with us, and Rabbi Joseph Ozarowski, the National Coordinator, for his input. We thank Beth Jacob Congregation for hosting tonight's program, and particularly to Dr. Aaron Jessen, the President, for his commitment to and ongoing support of quality educational programs. We would also like to thank Kurt Rothschild and Saul Kashitsky for their leadership, and also the very many people from within our community who have done the work, come to meetings, made announcements, and given donations and encouragement along the way. We could not have made this happen without you. Naftali Winter, the president of the board of Netivot HaTorah Day School, one of the participating schools, and a lawyer himself, will be introducing our guest speaker.
For us to be involved in the worthy endeavors of the Orthodox Caucus, and it is a particular honor for me to introduce our guest speaker this evening, Nathan Lewin. Nathan Lewin was born on January 31st, 1936, in Lodz, Poland. His grandfather was the Rav of Russia and a member of the Polish legislature, and his father was a member of the Lodz City Council. Mr. Lewin first arrived in the United States in 1941. He received his BA degree from Yeshiva College, summa cum laude, in 1957. He then graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School in 1960 and started working for the United States government. He served as law clerk to Justice Harlan of the Supreme Court of the United States and then provided his services to the administration of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson when he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice and held the rank of Deputy Assistant Secretary of State at the U.S. State Department. In 1980, he was retained as special counsel by the Department of Justice Special Investigations Unit to prosecute the case of Valerie Trifa, an alleged war criminal. He has taught constitutional law at Harvard and other law schools and is presently teaching at Columbia Law School. Mr. Lewin is also a practicing attorney in Washington, D.C., and he has argued 27 cases in the Supreme Court of the United States. He has has represented such diverse clients as President Richard Nixon, actress Jodie Foster, musician John Lennon, Teamsters President Roy Williams, and Israeli war hero Avraham Sella. Mr. Lewin has argued many cases on behalf of Orthodox Jewish causes before the Supreme Court of the United States, such as representing in separate actions the communities of Lubavitch and Satmar, the right of a U.S. Air Force psychologist to wear a yarmulke while on duty, and against Yale University on the right of Orthodox students who did not want to reside in co-ed dormitories. He has drafted the provision of New York's domestic relations law that conditions the issuance of a civil divorce on removal of barriers to remarriage, such as the delivery of a get. Mr. Lewin has also defended in court the process of shechita and the rights of communities to construct an eruv. He is currently defending the constitutionality of New York's kosher food laws. Mr. Lewin is married to Ricky Gordon, a freelance photographer, and he has two daughters, Aliza Doba, also a lawyer, and Na'ama Batya, a photographer. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Nathan Lewin.
Thank you, Naftali, for that very generous and detailed introduction. I mean, starting with my yichus, I mean, my date of birth, I mean, this is almost a state secret. I mean, when one gets to this age already, you know, when one's year of birth is in the 30s, you know, you wonder about the passage of time. You said I worked in the Kennedy and Johnson administration. Somebody who recently introduced me at another event that I was speaking at also sort of said the same thing. I worked in the Kennedy and Johnson administration, and somebody from the audience yelled out, "Which Johnson?" There was an Andrew Johnson who in the 1870s, I think, was president of the United States. You've also been kind enough to mention all the personal details, and I just have to share with this audience an absolutely unbelievable story that happened at dinner this evening. When I had heard from my wife, the former Ricky Gordon, many times, I can't say many times, a number of times, how before we were married, when she made her first trip to Israel in 1960, and I think was returning by way of Europe, she had stopped off in Rome, got off at the train station, and was looking for a kosher pension that she had the address of, so she would be staying there for a couple of days that she would be seeing Rome. And then she said, she had told me the story, she met a very handsome, tall, South African young man who from Johannesburg who was also in Rome and was also looking for this kosher pension. So I had heard the story and I stored it in the back of my mind. And then this evening at dinner, when I'm sitting with Ilana and Jay, I again have to thank Aksanya. You have to start thanking your hosts, and they were serving marvelous dinner with Ilana's parents. And suddenly, Aubrey says, when I mention that my father-in-law is, my wife's family name is Gordon, he says, well, I met a young lady named Rena Gordon in Rome, 1960. There it was. There was the person who my wife had met in Rome in 1960 for just 2 days, I think, or 3 days. And here, happenstance, years later, I show up in Toronto to remake that acquaintance. So, you know, you wonder really about Yad Hashem, I mean, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in mind for us. When I accepted this invitation to come here, that was certainly a pleasure that I never anticipated I would be receiving here. The one thing you left out is the name of my firm. I can hand out business cards. People say, you know, Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin is the name of the firm. It sounds like a dream political ticket. I mean, the Miller isn't Jewish, it's a German Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin. You know, you have all ethnic varieties there. But people say to me, how come, Lewin, you're such a big knocker, you argued 27 cases in the Supreme Court, why are you the last name in the name of that law firm? And then, of course, I explain to them that my clients read from right to left. So, that, now, I'm to speak to you tonight about Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem, And I would like to save time for really for questions and for discussion, because I think that's really the most interesting part of a presentation of this kind. What I don't have before me is what I'm accustomed to having as a lawyer arguing cases in the United States, and particularly in the Supreme Court of the United States. You stand up before the rostrum, and you have two lights in the Supreme Court. If you ever go to visit it in Washington, D.C., there's a sort of yellow light and a red light. The yellow light tells you when you have 5 minutes left, because you're allowed only 30 minutes, and precisely 30 minutes, to present your argument. When the 30 minutes is up, you may be in the middle of a word, in the middle of a syllable. The Chief Justice expects you to sit down. When that light goes up, you sit down, period. It's an invariable rule in the Supreme Court. So lawyers learn to time themselves not to exceed that 30-minute limitation. I don't have that before me. But I will tell you an account I had the privilege, really, of being responsible for having the then President or Chief Justice of the Israel Supreme Court, Meir Shamgar, and his deputy, Menachem Elon, were in Washington a number of years ago for a lawyers' convention, and I said to them, have you ever been to the Supreme Court of the United States? And they said, no, we never have. I said, well, let me arrange that for you. So I called up the marshal, and I said, the Chief Justice of Israel and the deputy are here, would like to visit. Marvelous, they arranged it. They sat up front in a special box that's reserved for guests of Supreme Court justices, and it was a very spirited morning of argument. They started 10 o'clock, two cases heard till 12 o'clock. The lawyers were asking questions, the judges were asking questions, justices, the lawyers were answering, very, very exciting arguments. And then I walked out of the courtroom with them, and as we were walking out, I say to both, Justices Shamgar and Elon, I say, well, what did you think of that? They say, oh, very impressive, very impressive. I said, well, what was it that impressed you the most? And I thought they would say, you know, marvelous room, or they would say the justices were so prepared, the questions were so good, the lawyers were so good. They both immediately, both independently responded with one thing for each side of me. They said, that red light. We love that red light. They said, lawyers in Israel don't know when to stop. They keep talking, and we say to them, we've heard enough. And they say, no, no, we have a right to speak. You're depriving our clients of their civil rights. So they enjoyed the fact that there's a limit to what a speaker can say, and I will give you the same privilege here today of really trying to limit my time even without a red light. My subject, as I say, is Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. And when I thought about how to really discuss it with you today in the context of really what the law and what legal experience that I've had over the years that I've been practicing law in the United States, how it impacts on that, it seemed to me that the way really to focus on it and really to convey maybe some of my experiences is to look at the two references to Chilul Hashem in Pirkei Avos. In the fourth perek, Pirkei Avos tells us that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka said, "Kol hamachalel shem shamayim baseser." Everybody who secretly is guilty of profaning the name of Hashem, being machalel shem shamayim, nifraim mimenu begolim. He pays for it in public, open. And then it goes on to say, "Echad shogeg ve'echad mezid." Bechilul Hashem. Whether you do it deliberately or inadvertently, b'shogeg, by negligence or by ignorance, it's the same, Bechilul Hashem. It's a very enigmatic statement, really. What do they mean by Machalel Shem Shamayim Baseser? You Machalel Shem Shamayim secretly. We know Chilul Hashem means doing something in public, which is an embarrassment or a chilul Hashem. What is the significance of the word seiser, that you do it secretly? And what is the significance of moving from seiser to golui, to saying, if you do it b'seiser, then nifra'in imenu, he will pay for it b'golui, openly. What is the meaning of he will pay for it? finally, since when is the punishment, if that's what's meant by it, for a mazid and a shogeg the same? Echad mazid ve'echad shogeg b'chol Hashem. It seems to be saying they're the same. That's contrary to all the principles that we know of about punishment for things that you do wrong. Then we come to the other passage in Pirkei Avos. In the fifth perek, the Pirkei Avos tells us that there are seven forms of misfortune. Shiva minei peronios, which ba'in le'olam al shiva gufei averos, which come as a result of seven bodies of sins, as it were. And the sixth of these is chaya ra'a ba'a li'olam al shvua shav ba'achilul Hashem. Wild beasts come to the world because of false swearing and because of chilul Hashem, because of shvua shav, unnecessary or false swearing. Well, what, first of all, what's the relationship between shvua shav and chilul Hashem? And why is the specific punishment wild animals, chaya ra'a? And what's meant by chaya ra'a? What are we talking about? That's a punishment that comes to the world because of shvua shav and chilul Hashem. Well, let me give you some of my experiences over these 40 years, which I think maybe lend a little substance and a little body to these things that Pirkei Avos teach us. Let me begin by telling you of a case that just about a quarter of a century ago generated a substantial storm in the Jewish community in New York and elsewhere. And it prompted, at that time, the formation of many organizations devoted to fighting Chilul Hashem. At that time, I was teaching on a one-year stint, sort of a break from private practice, at the Harvard Law School. And I began representing a central figure in a criminal investigation conducted in New York City into the nursing home industry. My client was a well-known philanthropist in the Orthodox Jewish community, and he had held posts of distinction in various Jewish organizations. He was also a rabbi. He had gotten smicha. He owned a string of nursing homes. And the New York Times became interested in that subject because of the experience, not necessarily in his nursing home, but in a nursing home, of the parent of one of the editors. An investigation began into allegations of financial misconduct and patient abuse in nursing homes. Now, many of you may know the name of the client I had, but I don't think it's necessary to identify him by name tonight. He had many achievements to his credit, and taking very good advice of my wife, who you heard had the good taste to meet this young man in Rome then, I visited the nursing homes before I agreed to do the representation of this man. And when I visited his nursing homes, I saw no abusive conditions there. I saw no reason, from what I could tell, for criminal allegations regarding abuse of the nursing homes. After I undertook the representation, I and my associates, who then included a young Harvard Law School graduate named Jamie Gorelick, who went on to become Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration and is one of the few people, really, who left the Reno Department of Justice with absolutely the very highest grades and credits in her favor by the press and the public. She was then a young associate in my office. We worked together with others on behalf of this client, and we rebutted the specific allegations of abuse. But both the federal and state prosecutors persisted in a zealous investigation and refused to close that file. A Senate committee hearing was held, which was televised live in New York. I became an instant celebrity. I remember going on the plane and having the stewardesses say, "Oh, I saw you on television today at the hearing of the nursing home industry." And my client sat during that hearing because I told him to sit as he thought was comfortable, wearing a yarmulke. I did not. I sat next to him as his lawyer. And it achieved enormous publicity. Many at that point, as I say, criticized this whole episode and the investigation as a Chilul Hashem. But I can tell you from my investigation that the media treatment and the community treatment was excessive. He was treated as an outlaw. There was no real substantive violation of law that was ever lodged against him. But in order to end his pursuit by the press and to close the case, he pleaded guilty to the offense of agreeing to have a partnership return filed with the United States in which a partner of his was not named. A false partnership return. No financial benefit to it. He pleaded guilty, and a federal judge, a fair federal judge, had a full hearing on the punishment that this man deserved. He could have sentenced him to 5 years in jail, but after going through the entire case, this federal judge sentenced my client to 4 months in jail. His opinion in that case, it now appears in many criminal law case books on the subject of sentencing, because it's a very thoughtful and I think correct treatment of what sentence a man should get. And he said it was a very limited charge after a long investigation. This is all that could be found. And the full sentence should be 4 months. But there was such a storm in New York as a result of that lenient sentence. So much hatred from the press that the state prosecutor, notwithstanding the agreement they plainly had with us, proceeded against him. He was forced to plead guilty again in state court and ended up spending another year in state jail at Rikers Island. There was, at the very same time, at least one and many other nursing home owners who had done the same or worse things as my client had done. But the prosecutor did not pursue them as zealously. They escaped with no jail sentence, or with a much milder punishment than my client did. Why did that happen? Were they better represented? Maybe so. But the answer I like to think is that for all my client's very good public deeds, he had also made many enemies in his business dealings. When the news reports of the investigation of him began, individuals who felt that he had cheated them as a partner in business or had not treated them properly called the prosecutors, called the press, and added fuel to the fire. They, with their grievances, really stirred up the case against him. Had he committed any misconduct in dealing with those business associates? That wasn't my business. I was never sure about that, but I was astounded by the number of people who made these kinds of assertions against him. And they lent credibility to the picture that was drawn in the media about him. By contrast, the other leading nursing home owner was publicly supported by his past business associates. They rallied to his defense. They said he was a man of integrity and that he should not be criminally prosecuted. Now, honesty in business dealings with non-Jews, even more than with Jews, is the very core of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. The Gemara in Yuma defines Chilul Hashem as even when a Rav delays paying his butcher by one day for the meat that he has received from him. If my client did in fact deal with less than total integrity with individuals who were in business with him, then I think he engaged in Chilul Hashem B'Seisei. Only his business partners may have known about it at the time, of that side of his persona. But the observation of Rabbi Yochanan that the person who engages in Chilul Hashem B'Seisei is paid the galui, it seems to me, was realized in that case. Then what of the Shogeg and Mezid comparison? Does the Mishnah, is Pirkei Avos really telling us that a Mezid is like a Shogeg? I think really if you look at the text of Pirkei Avos, it's not saying that they're equal. It's saying Echad Mezid ve'Echad Shogeg b'Chilul Hashem. All those who are deliberately guilty and those who maybe are just negligent and involved are equally affected by the Chilul Hashem. Let me tell you another story of another client I had in New York, someone who was a leading figure in a Hasidic community and went to trial on a criminal charge in Manhattan federal court. And I represented him, and together with him, with other lawyers who represented members of his family who were on trial in a tax charge in federal court. We were picking a jury. And sitting out there among the prospective jurors were people from all walks of life. And the judge asked the prospective jurors, do any of you have anything against Orthodox Jews? My client was sitting in the courtroom with his yarmulke and his beard, as was another member of his family. And when the judge asked that question generally, nobody, not a single prospective juror raised his hand. I went up to the judge and I said, Your Honor, that's not a question that you can expect people to answer just in general like that. You should ask it to them individually. And the judge said to me, oh no, if anybody has a bias against Orthodox Jews, they'll admit it. I'll ask them, does anybody have any bias against Hasidic Jews? So then the judge says, does anybody have any bias against Hasidic Jews? No word, no response from anybody in the audience. The judge went on to other subjects. About 3 or 4 minutes later, one prospective juror raises his hand and says, Your Honor, you know, I'd like to approach the bench because I've been thinking about a question that you asked before. And he comes up to the front of the court, and there with the lawyers present, he says, well, Your Honor, you asked about whether anybody has any bias against Hasidic Jews. The truth of the matter is, I think I do, he says. My sister was a tenant of a man who was a Hasidic Jew, and he really gouged her, and I'm really upset about that. I have to admit. I says, okay, you're excused. The man was excused, and suddenly somebody else raises a hand and comes up and says, Your Honor, you know, I've been thinking about that question about Hasidic Jews, and I have to tell you that there's a member of my family that was really insulted by a Hasidic Jew some time ago, and I'm really biased against them. So I says, okay, you're excused. And then he turns to me, and I say, Your Honor, you know, I think that proves my point. I think you've got to call these jurors in individually and ask them about their bias. The judge says, okay, let's try it. We go back to the judge's chambers, and he starts calling in the jurors one by one. I can only tell you, I was appalled. I was appalled at the number of jurors in Manhattan, in New York City, sitting there, who in the presence of the judge in the chambers said, yes, I do have a bias because of something I've heard, because of something I've experienced, because of something I've seen against Hasidic Jews. And we ended up disqualifying maybe 10, 12 jurors on the basis of what they admitted in the judge's chamber. What is that? To me, that is Echad Mezid ve'Echad Shogeg v'Chilul Hashem. You don't have to be the one who does it yourself. But whether you're a Mezid or a Shogeg, you are affected by the Chilul Hashem. By the Chilul Hashem of someone else who has caused the community, as it were, to be thinking disparagingly of Orthodox Jews, of Hasidim or of Orthodox Jews. It's a critical situation that we're in this regard. The fact of the matter is that just a few days ago at the convention of Agudat Yisrael, the annual convention, the president of Agudat Yisrael, the Novominska Rebbe, Rabbi Perlow, said right here. He said, we are witnessing today a situation in our midst which cannot allow us any rest. The image of Torah Jews is being perceived as dishonest, unethical, and lacking in integrity. Scandals reported in the newspapers referring to Orthodox Jews, however exaggerated or untrue they may be, and many of them are politically motivated, abound with sheker, and seek to destroy good people, they are still causing Hillel Hashem. Questionable practices that involve Ben Adam Lechavero or Dina de Malchusa, either by individuals or institutions, the dichotomy in people's minds that separates between Glatt Kosher and Glatt Yosher, a mentality that believes in the premise that the Malchus Shel Chesed of the United States is to be exploited whenever possible using every device, is causing Shem Shamayim to be mishallel in huge proportions. Now, that's not my judgment. This is something which the Novominsker Rebbe said less than a week ago to the Convention of Agudas Yisrael. It was, he said, once upon a time, automatically assumed that an Orthodox Jew was a paradigm of ethical virtue. The more religious, the more ethical. But, he says, today, unfortunately, we have squandered our exalted image. Our Cheskas Kashrus has been eroded to the point where some would say it has been replaced by a Cheskas Chashad, assumption of suspicion, especially in the ultra corner of the Orthodox world. Now, I have seen it, and I've been critical of it. I've written publicly about the fact that I think that prosecutors now are treating Orthodox Jews and Brooklyn, this is U.S. prosecutors in Brooklyn, more severely than other citizens. But nonetheless, the sad fact is that that happens to be true. It doesn't have to be true. What the Novominsker Rebbe says is right. People begin with a Cheskas Kashrus. The number of people I have met over the years whose attitude towards orthodoxy and observance is affirmative is to me astounding. When I began my career with Justice John Marshall Harlan, a member of a distinguished American family, his grandfather was a Supreme Court justice. I became his clerk. Justice Harlan, at that point, there were only two clerks for every Supreme Court justice. Now there are four, and they decide half as many cases as they did in our day. But at that point, in my first interview with Justice Harlan, I said to him, Justice Harlan, I have to tell you, I'm a Sabbath observer. I have to leave early on Fridays. I can't be here on Saturdays. And Justice Harlan's response was, that's just fine, that. I have another clerk. He'll cover Saturday, and you can cover Sunday. It turned out the other clerk, by the way, was the son of an Anglican church archbishop. His name was Rhinelander. And Justice Harlan was very proud. He would come through into our office with visiting guests and would say, here are my two law clerks, John Rhinelander and Nat Lewin. One is the grandson of the Anglican archbishop, I think, of Pittsburgh, and the other one is the grandson of a chief rabbi of Poland, of Galicia. I mean, he didn't quite ever get it quite right, but nonetheless, he was very proud of that. The Supreme Court would have conferences on Fridays, Friday morning. I deliberately took an apartment that was within walking distance of the court, so I wouldn't have any problem making it home before Shki on Friday. But the amazing thing is, Justice Harlan would come out of the conference. That would be a time when he would be able to talk to the law clerks about what happened in the conference where only the Supreme Court justices were present. He would sit down with John Rhinelander and myself. We would go through the cases. It would be Friday afternoon. And it was more than once that Justice Harlan said to me, Nat, the sun's going to go down soon. You better go home. He was the one who was telling me that. I remember, this is just an aside, years later, it was very, very interesting, years later, when some postmen and postal officials in the United States were complaining to a congressman that they lost all their vacation time, these Orthodox Jewish postmen, because they had to take time off for Yom Tov. So they never had time that they could have other than Yuntiv time with the vacations with their families during the summer.
And a New York City congressman by the name of Stephen Solars said, well, maybe I'll introduce legislation to take care of this. And he said he introduced a bill that would require the government to allow compensatory time for religious observance, that if what you did is you had to take time off because it was your religious holiday, the government had to allow you to work extra during the few weeks before, or the few weeks after Yuntiv, so that you didn't have to take vacation time and you could take it during the summer. And when he introduced this legislation, this was in the Carter, years of the Carter administration, I remember, the Department of Justice, an assistant attorney general there, said, this is unconstitutional. It's a preference for religion. It gives people a preference because they're taking off for religious reasons, and that violates the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the prohibition against the establishment of religion. And Steve Solars called me up and said, now, what are we going to do? The Department of Justice is against us. He said, there's going to be a meeting at the White House. Can you join me at the meeting of the White House if you can defend this law? So I went with Steve Solars to a meeting at the White House where this Department of Justice official was there, and there were White House people, and the question was the Carter administration going to oppose this bill on the ground that it was unconstitutional? And the assistant attorney general made his argument about why this is a preference for religion. And then Congressman Solars turned to me and said, okay, now Nat Lewin here is going to explain why it's constitutional. And I was left with that burden. So I tried to make a legal argument. And then the story about Justice Harlan popped into my head. And I said to them, look, let me tell you what happened when I clerked for Justice Harlan, who was a conservative justice on the Supreme Court. And I told him, I said, look, he knew I was a Sabbath observer, and he would say to me Friday afternoons, Nat, it's time for you to go home because the sun goes down. It's soon going down. And I said to this group at the White House, I said, do you think that Justice Harlan thought he was violating the Constitution when he said to me that I can go home early on Fridays? And there was silence. And the next day, Congressman Solars called me, and he said they called him up, and they said that that instance, that story, just tipped the scales totally. And the administration supported the bill, which is now federal law, so that if you take a job as a postman in the United States or as any federal official, you can get compensatory time off for taking off on Yuntiv. But that's the kind of reaction you get. I worked in the office of the Solicitor General arguing cases in the Supreme Court. And Thurgood Marshall became Solicitor General. I had worked before for another Solicitor General named Archibald Cox. Then he left, and Thurgood Marshall became Solicitor General. And I remember I came into Thurgood Marshall one of the first days he was on the job. He had inherited me with the other members of the staff. And I said to him, you know, Judge, he had been a judge on the court. This was before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. I said, Judge, I want to introduce myself, Matt Lewin, this and that. And I said, you know, one thing I want to tell you is, you know, I'm a Sabbath observer, so I have to leave early on Fridays. And I start telling the story, and Thurgood Marshall says to me, Nat, don't bother. I know it all. I said, Judge, I don't think you really understand. What happens is I have to leave before sundown on Fridays, and then there's a couple of them. He says, Nat, I know it all. I said, how do you know that? And Marshall says to me, Nat, I was born and I grew up in Baltimore, in the Jewish area. He says, I was the Shabbos guy in the neighborhood. And Marshall's reaction and his response to the Jews he knew and whom he had met in Baltimore was all favorable, because the people he met had integrity, were people of really commanded respect. So, and of course, I mean, you know, we all know that now we're at the stage in the United States where a vice presidential candidate can not only be Jewish. I mean, everybody makes a big deal about the vice presidential candidate being Jewish, but the point, the really important point, is what he has brought in terms of the understanding of Jewish observance and the respect for Jewish observance. So, that's what Kiddush Hashem should be. That's what it should be among the nations of the world. It's difficult. It doesn't come easily.
Naftali mentioned the Reish HaRav. I can't really go through a talk here in a shul without giving you a little bit of a drasha, a little vart from the Reish HaRav, because it tells us a little bit about the attitudes of the non-Jewish world to the Jewish community. In this week's Sedra, Avimelech says to Yitzchak, Lech me'imanu ki yotzamta mimenu ma'od. The Reish HaRav, who after all was in the world, he was a member of the Polish parliament, he knew the non-Jewish world, and he knew its attitude towards Jews. He said, look, Avimelech's reaction to Yitzchak was a sign really for what the Jews have to see as their position in the world through the years. Ma'ase avos simon labanim. What happens to the fathers is a sign for what will happen to the sons. What was Yitzchak after all? Yitzchak lived, came to the land of Avimelech, poor, not having any wealth, and that's what happens. The Goyim look at the Jewish people and they say, oh, you're here, you're trying to sponge off us, you know, we are very critical of you because you're simply trying to live off the world that we have created. But then when the Jew succeeds in that world, that all turns to jealousy. Lech me'imanu ki otzamta mimenu ma'od, he said, is the attitude of the non-Jew to the Jew. Leave because your success, ki otzamta mimenu, your success comes from us. We begrudge you your success. That's the attitude generally of the non-Jewish world to the Jew. And that's what makes it so important that a Jew act in a way that engenders respect for Torah and for Shem Shamayim in the world around him. What about the second of the lessons in Pirkei Avos? Shiva Gufei Averos, there are seven bodies of sins, and Chaya Ra'a comes al Shvua Shav v'al Chilul Hashem. What's the combination between Shvua Shav and Chilul Hashem? With Chaya Ra'a? Well, I'll tell you, it seems to me that maybe that reference is to a particular form of Chilul Hashem, which I have to tell you I am unfortunately exposed to at different times. The form of Chilul Hashem that results from the Jew taking another Jew to a secular court. It's a Chilul Hashem. There's just no doubt about it. The Rambam says in the very last chapter of Sanhedrin, of the Halachos of Sanhedrin, Kol Hadon B'dayonei Akum Uva Arko Shalahem. Everybody who takes another Jew to a secular court, Afal Pi Shahayu Dinehem Kedinei Yisrael, Hare Zer Rosha, that's a Chilul Hashem. There's just no doubt about it. Taking another Jew to a secular court is a form of Chilul Hashem. It's related to Shvua Shav. Of course, the two are together. Shvua Shav and Chilul Hashem, swearing out a complaint. It's become a common thing now, at least in the courts of New York, to sue rabbis. I'm representing rabbis and a rabbinical Beis Din in a lawsuit that's been brought in New York by a woman who was unhappy over what the Beis Din did, when what the Beis Din did was entirely appropriate within the province of the Beis Din, and she has gone out and brought a lawsuit in the state of New York, hired a non-Jewish lawyer, blackened the names of the rabbis who are members of the Beis Din with false allegations made against them for her own purposes. That is, I think, a Chilul Hashem. There is a, funny in terms of Toronto, there is a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein's which involved a case from Toronto, as a matter of fact, 1962. where there was a woman who had received a get on the understanding with the assistance of Rav Moshe Feinstein. This appears in volume 4 of his Tshuvos on Eben Hazar. She had received a get from, with the assistance of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the pressure put on the husband with the understanding that she would then cooperate in obtaining a divorce from the court.